Anyway, so we're sitting here doing our last class in this three-class session of the surrendered life. We've talked about the surrendered life is a surrounded life and how God is involved in our lives even today. Obviously, serving and spiritual, those aspects of the surrendered life. We've mentioned that, you know, in thinking about surrender and this concept, we're not surrendering ourselves to an enemy. We're not surrendering ourselves to somebody who would see us harm, but we are surrendering ourselves to God. If we do not surrender ourselves to God, we are by default surrendering ourselves to somebody who would see us harm. Look at Romans chapter 6, verse 16. Romans 6, 16. Do you not know that when you present yourselves to someone as slaves for obedience, you are slaves for the one to whom you obey, either of sin resulting to death or of obedience resulting to righteousness? So we choose those. There really are two camps. There's no real gray area in this. And so whoever you choose to render yourself to, I would choose God, just saying, if you it's up in the air for you right now. So we're going to be looking at a shining life. The surrendered life is a shining life. This is not the all work and no play shining, but it is a concept of how we represent or how we are represented to the world around us. Look at Matthew chapter 5. This is going to be a passage that you're probably familiar with. Matthew chapter 5, 14 through 16. It says, "You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the lampstand and gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven." As we think about a shining life, what are we talking about here? What are we shining? Reflections of God, of God's light, of God's light applied to our lives. It has to do a lot with our influence. Look at John chapter 8. John chapter 8 and verse 12. Then Jesus again spoke to them, saying, "I am the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." Of course, we see, as you mentioned before, that is Christ is the source of that light. That is what we are supposed to be reflecting to the world around us. Look at Philippians 2. Philippians chapter 2, verse 15. Do we think about, on a day-to-day basis, do we think about kind of how we're representing Christ, representing the church? Let's start in verse 14. "Do all things without grumbling or disputing, so that you will prove yourselves to be blameless, innocent, children of God, above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as," what? "Lights in the world." Among whom you appear as lights in the world, holding fast that word of life. We sing songs about this, right? Let the lower lights keep burning. Do we know like that's the sailor terminology that's used as far as a lighthouse upon the shore? What are we shining a light for? The way? Yes, like a beacon. Are we supposed to warn against dangers? Light is really good for that. Light is excellent for that. How many of you have been somewhere when it's completely dark? I mean, not like quasi-dark, where you can kind of still make... How many of you have been in a cave and turned all the lights off completely? Isn't it amazing how dark it is? It almost like seeps into you, it's so dark. You know, in John, when the Gospel of John, talking about Christ, he says, Christ shone, and the light could not comprehend, it could not overcome the light that was Christ, is the image that's there in the first chapter of John. But it feels that way in a cave. And I was in a cave one time, and somebody had like one of, remember the Indiglo watches? I guess they still have those. Timex Indigo. And so somebody, which is not very much light, by the way, and somebody shone just that light in a cave that was completely dark. And it was amazing at what that little light was able to do in that environment. What kind of light are we showing to the world around us? What kind of influence are we having to the darkness, complete darkness, among whom you shine as lights in the world? That's quite a responsibility. And we said we were going to do that, right? We said we were going to do that whenever we signed on, so to speak. But as we look at examples, look in Romans chapter 2. We have an example here, the Jews, about their failure to shine. They were not representing what they're supposed to be representing in Romans chapter 2. He says, beginning of verse 17, "But if you bear the name of Jew and rely on the law and boast in God and know His will and approve the things which are essential, being instructed out of the law, and are confident that you yourself are a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in darkness, a corrector of the foolish, a teacher of the immature, having in the law the embodiment of knowledge and of truth, you therefore who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that one shall not steal, do you steal? You who say that you should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who boast in the law, though you're breaking the law, do you dishonor God? For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, just as it is written." And so Paul kind of gets kind of harsh right there, right? That would not be acceptable. You can't judge me. You don't know if I mean, that would be kind of what would be said today. That's kind of harsh, Paul. Nobody likes that kind of preaching. But did they need to hear that? If you don't shine a light, what's going to happen? You're going to run right into those rocks if you're not shining a light. And we're talking about how we do that a little bit later. But in this context, they're the ones that are boasting in the law. They're the ones that are saying, "Hey, this is the way you're supposed to live." And they're shaking the finger at everybody else. And what is Paul saying here about them? Were they doing it? No. Jesus said, you search high and low to find a proselyte, but you make them twice the sons of hell as yourself. Jesus, that's kind of harsh. We don't need to be saying that kind of stuff in church. But that's what he's saying about that kind of attitude that shines righteousness, tries to show their righteousness, but it's not the righteousness of God. Now, is that saying that we're perfect? No. It's not. But if we're humble enough to realize that, and realize that we're all striving to work towards what's right. And so that's the failure to shine is the attention that's got there. Look at the way we shine is important. As we read there in Matthew chapter 5, verse 17, "Let your light before men shine before men in such a way." The King James would say, "Let your light so shine." What is that? What are we talking about? In such a way, or so shine. Do you know it's the same word that we see in John 3:16? "For God so loved the world." There was a way that God loved the world. What was that way that's mentioned there? In John 3:16. I mean, everybody knows this one. What's that? "But He gave His only begotten Son," right? You know, you see that even on Sundays at football games, right? So that's the go-to verse for everybody. So God so loved the world. Let your light shine in such a way. What way? Can light be annoying? So you're sleeping in on Saturday, which hardly ever happens. Some of you are rolling your eyes like, "Yeah, right." Which hardly ever happens sometimes. And then that light, that, you know, you have blinds, but there's those lights like where the blinds come together and they shine right in your face. Is that annoying? It's quasi-annoying, right? And then as we looked at passage in Romans chapter 2, I imagine that that's like a false light. That they try and shine and they try and polish themselves up and they try and be this righteous, but it's not really a true light. It's not really true representation of Christ. Oh yes, very low. And the opposite's true too. Just enough light to know that there's something there, but not enough light to really know what to do about it is just as dangerous. Yes, sir. Oh yeah. Yeah, and that's whosoever will, right? I mean, you can show them, you know, here's the path. You're going to stub your toe. Oh, you just stubbed your toe? Well, I told you it was going to happen. You can show them, but if they're not going to do it, then they're not going to do it. But there's a way to shine that's appropriate. And in this case, let your light so shine before men that they would glorify you. Oh, Josh, you're so awesome. Thank you. No, it's not about us. It never is about us. The message is always about shining light on God and the message that He has done because He so loved the world. The why is important also. And we see this in several passages in the Bible, the why. The why. Look in Galatians chapter 1. Chapter 1, verse 10. It says, "For am I now seeking the favor of men or of God? Or am I striving to please men? If I were still striving or trying to please men, I would not be a bondservant of Christ." He says, what's my motivation? You know, if I was really trying to please people, I wouldn't be preaching God. I wouldn't be preaching Christ. And in Paul's context, he'd been like stoned and thrown, run out of cities and all kinds of stuff because he was preaching Christ. So if he was trying to please men, he'd probably want to change his message because that one's not working so good, right? But we need to consider what our motivation is. Look over in the next passage we have here in Philippians chapter 1. Philippians chapter 1, beginning of verse 15. "Some, to be sure, are preaching Christ from envy and strife, but some also from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am appointed to be for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition, rather than from pure motives, thinking to cause me distress in my imprisonment. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in this I rejoice." "Yes, and I will rejoice, for I know that this will turn out for my deliverance through your prayers and the provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, according to my earnest expectation and hope that I will not be put to shame in anything, but that with all boldness Christ will then, even now, as always, be exalted in my body, whether by life or death." What was the motivation for Paul? What was his why? What was most important for him in this text? What did he want more than life and death himself? What did he want to happen? Some of you are saying it. This is class. Y'all can talk. I'm not preaching. What's that? He wanted to live for Christ. He wanted that message out there, no matter what happened to him. Nevertheless, what? Christ was preached. It didn't matter even what happened to him. What was most important that the message was out there. So his life, in life or death, if it could further the gospel, that was what was most important to him. That's a pretty mature choice. Not all of us are at that point, maybe necessarily. Hopefully we don't have to experience that extreme kind of situation. Look at Matthew chapter 6, verse 1. Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. We could see that Paul's motivation wasn't, it wasn't about him. It was that the message was out there. And sometimes it's easy to get caught up in this concept that I need to make sure that I'm doing the things that are accepted so that people see me and my righteousness is seen. And that's a dangerous place because you have no reward for that kind of righteousness. There's no reward for that. It's a dangerous place to be in. Let's look at very quickly the next point. The universal cry of the spiritually starved is, we would see Jesus. In John chapter 12, verse 21, the Greeks came to Jesus, or the Greeks came and they wanted to see Jesus. They said, we would see Jesus. And the text doesn't tell us that Jesus even acknowledged them. It doesn't say that he went and spoke to them. It does say that at that moment, things kind of changed. There was a shift. And he says, now is the time. As though the Greeks coming to him was that sign that it was time for things to kind of shift in the message and the ministry. But we would see Jesus. No matter where you go, people want, who are spiritually starving, who want to know more about what the Bible is, they want to see Jesus. I've told you this before, but we've been studying with people, and they say, we've never studied it this way. We've never sat down and systematically read for our own eyes what the message of the gospel is. We've never studied it this way before. They've never seen Jesus biblically portrayed and come alive from the scriptures because they've been given a twisted, perverted, different concept of who Jesus was. Well, Jesus is always loving, and you know that 70s microbus Jesus, you know, that a lot of people want to preach. But there's the Jesus who said, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees. So it's not a complete picture. He is the God of love, but he's also God of justice. We will be judged by him. So we're not always painted a complete picture of who Jesus is, and they want to see Jesus. And the question is, what is your response? What is your response to that question? We want to see Jesus. What is your response? How do we respond to that? How would you respond to that? That would be good, right? That's the ideal situation. Did y'all hear that? They should be seeing Jesus in us, as far as us applying what Christ has taught us to apply to our lives. And seeing those attributes, have this mind in you, which was also, and so that kind of concept, they should be seeing that. And they should see that we're different. That is where shining comes into place. That is where having an influence on the world around us comes into place. That's where a true surrendered life comes into play. Look at Acts chapter 4, verse 13. Look at Acts chapter 4, verse 13. They started preaching this gospel. And again, it wasn't popular for everybody. It wasn't something everybody wanted to hear. But this is interesting and concerning some of the apostles. Chapter 4, verse 13. Now, as they observed the confidence of Peter and John and understood that they were uneducated, untrained men, they were amazed and began to recognize them as having been with Jesus. Now, I don't want to call your education into play here, but that doesn't matter. What matters here is that we've been with Jesus. Education doesn't matter. I'm not saying, well, parents are cringing right now, but I'm about to send my child. No, okay. Do what you need to do. I've heard parents in this room say, I don't care what my child does. I don't care if they dig ditches for the rest of their life, as long as they have a spiritual relationship with Christ, and that is most important. That is what's most important. Guys, you're off the hook, apparently. Just kidding. Never mind. Glassed stairs. What is he talking about? He's addressing us right now. Okay, anyway. So, do you understand what we're talking about? They recognized that they had been with Jesus. Why? What does it say? This is an open book. Y'all can read this too if you. What does it say? The boldness. They were bold. The confidence that they had. The message, I'm sure, was spot on the same. They recognize that they had been with. Do people recognize that of us? Are we shining like we're supposed to? Yes, sir, that would be assertive in the message that they're. Yes. Now, that's not assertive. There's a lot of different ways you can be assertive, but there we're talking here about the message that they were, the boldness. They were already told not, you know, they're going to be told not to preach, but they keep doing it anyway. Even after getting beat, they continue to preach. And so they were bold in that aspect. And so they recognized by those around them, their enemies, that they had been with Christ, that there was an influence that Christ had had on them. Any questions, comments about shining as far as our influence? You've probably heard lessons on that before, but I think we need reminders from time to time that we need to keep the lights burning. As difficult as it is sometimes, as much as the darkness is around us and feels oppressive and feels like it's creeping into us, we need to keep the lights burning. We need to keep shining, because sometimes you are just the person that somebody needs to see. You are just the person that somebody needs in their life. We are keepers of the lighthouse, that's right. So we need to keep that sense of urgency about us. Let's look at the next concept. The surrendered life is a serene life. Now, what does it mean to be serene? We know we have to use an S because we're using all S's here, and that helps me remember things. But what does serene mean? Calm, relaxed, legs crossed, fingers out, incense burning. You know, is that your life? Is that your life? No, it's not. It is not your life. That is not our lives on a day-to-day basis, that kind of concept, this zen, this state. But a serene life, is it something that we can achieve? Yes. Is it something that can be ours? Yes. Is it something that the world around us wants to rob from us on a day-to-day basis? Yes. But let's look at this. The man, a man, man was made to be happy. Look at Psalm 1. And it uses the word blessed. It can be interchanged with happy is the man. But what does this man do in Psalm chapter 1, verse 1? Do you remember? And yes, how blessed or happy is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in this his law he meditates day and night. And it goes on to talk about what will happen with this type of person. But this is a person that can be happy. Let's continue with the wisdom literature and look at Proverbs chapter 3, talking about wisdom. Proverbs chapter 3. How blessed is a man who finds wisdom, and the man who gains understanding. For her profit is better than profit of silver, and her gain better than fine gold. She is more precious than jewels, and nothing you desire compares with her. Long life is in her right hand, and in her left hand riches and honor. Her ways are pleasant, her ways are the paths of peace. She is a tree of life to those who take hold of her, and happy are all who hold her fast. The Lord, by wisdom, founded the earth. By understanding, he established the heavens. And so as we look at this passage, you know, it almost sounds like a love letter to the concept of wisdom. But are we talking about just any old wisdom? We're talking about God's wisdom. The wisdom that comes from God, and holding on to that type of wisdom. Deuteronomy chapter 32, as we, you know, some of us finished studying that book. And in the end of that book, kind of part of Moses' last address last public address to the people, right before he's called to go to his mountain. Deuteronomy chapter 32, verses 46 and 47. He said to them, Take to your heart all the words which I am warning you today, which you shall command to your sons to observe carefully, even all the words of this law. For it is not an idle word for you, indeed it is your life. And by this word you will prolong your days in the land which you are about to cross the Jordan to possess. So you look as Moses finishes this discourse and finishes this last message before the people go into the promised land. He says, you need to pay attention to this why. What's the why behind paying attention to this message? What does he say here? It's your life. It will prolong your days in that promised land. Is that any different today? Could we preach that same kind of concept today? Is this not our life? And will it not prolong our days in that promised land to come? And as we think about this concept of happiness, look at Matthew 5 again. We won't take the time to read all of that, but what word comes over and over and over again in Matthew chapter 5, 2 through 12? What word do we see? Blessed. Same kind of, again, that concept of happiness. Happy are the poor in spirit. What? So as you go through that list, those are really, you know, not things that we would consider to be blessed, to be in those different situations. But the Bible tells us, yes, you can be blessed in those situations. Let's look at 1 Peter chapter 3. And we are running out of time so quickly. 1 Peter chapter 3, 10 through 12. 10 through 12. For the one who desires life, to love and see good days, does anybody want that? That's sort of like, that's part of like the American dream, right? It doesn't have like two cars in every garage, but anyway. Must keep his tongue from evil, his lips from speaking deceit. He must turn away from evil and do good. He must seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Is that a warning? Is he sort of vague on that? Not quite sure what he means there. No, he's pretty explicit. If you would, what does he say? The one who desires life, to love and see good days. Mind your tongue. Obey God. Be obedient. Turn away from doing evil. Seek peace. Are those easy concepts? I mean, the tongue is hard to control, right? Any of you said something that you wish you could just kind of suck back into your face? I think we've all been there at some point. But these are all concepts that have to be in control. And as we look at the spiritual life, it can be a serene life, but a life based on God. We need to understand also that we're not promised that this life is going to be cakewalk, right? We're not promised that kind of promise. Are we given that promise? We are given the promise that if we apply these principles to our lives, that we don't have to deal with some of the other problems that come with sin. Have you heard of some circumstances that come with those who practice sin? Have you had to deal with circumstances because of sin in your life? It's not fun, is it? It's not fun. There are so many things that happen because of sin, that things that could be avoided if we would just apply godly principles to our lives. What about our country? If everybody in our country, and this is not going to happen, but if everybody in our country lived by godly principles, what kind of country would we have? What kind of state would we have if just this state? That's probably not going to happen. What about just this county? Maybe. Do you think this county, do you think we can get everybody in this county to, and we'll put borders up and say, you have to be a Christian to come in? No, that's probably not going to happen. But what about us here? What kind of great place would it be if every one of us here applied these principles in our lives? Would that be something you want to be a part of? I would want to be a part of that. And so that can be a source for us. If we look at defining happiness, Paul talks about in Philippians 4, 11, about being content. And that's a pesky word, you know. How many of you can be content with something? What, is content happiness? Usually the word contentment has this concept that I can deal with whatever is going on. I can find a way to deal with it, but it's not, you know, this tipping through the tulips happiness kind of concept. Look at Hebrews 13:5, just to quickly get through this. How are we on time? We got added on. We got extra times, right? We got 5 minutes. Awesome. Okay. We got extra times. Okay, Hebrews 13:5. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. So you confidently say, verse 6, the Lord is my redeemer. I will not be afraid. What will man do to me? And so he talks about here being content with the things that we have, being content with the money we have, because why? I will never leave you or forsake you. Is that a pretty good promise? So these are some concepts as far as defining what happiness. Look at James chapter 1, verse 12. Should just, for some of you, it may be across the page. James chapter 1, verse 12. Blessed is a man who perseveres under trial, for once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those that love him. Are you looking forward to that? Are you looking forward to that happiness and that serenity that nobody can take away from you? I think I am. Let's get reminded real quick before we leave. Look at Revelation chapter 7. Verse 13. Let's be reminded really quick what we're fighting for here sometimes. Revelation 7:13. Then one of the elders answered, saying to me, these who are clothed in white robes, who are they? And where have they come from? And I said to him, my Lord, you know. And he said to me, these are the ones who came out of the great tribulation. Ignore this, just the great tribulation. This is pretty great, right? This is tribulation. So let's look past that, but look at what we're saying here. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Do we understand what that is? We understand what that is, to be baptized into Christ and being washed in the blood of the Lamb. For this reason, they are before the throne of God. They serve Him day and night in His temple. And He who sits on the throne will spread His tabernacle over them. They will hunger no longer, nor thirst any more, nor will the sun beat down on them, nor any heat. For the Lamb is in the center of the throne, will be their shepherd, and He will guide them to the springs of water of life. And God will wipe away the tear from every tear from their eyes. And very quickly over in chapter 21, to finish, chapter 21, beginning in verse 1. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there is no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and He will dwell among them, and they shall be His people, and God Himself will be among them, and He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will no longer be any death, and there will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away. We're in the first things. These will all pass away. And He who sits on the throne said, behold, I am making all things new. And He said, write, these words are faithful and true. Then He said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give to the one who thirsts from the spring of water of life without cost. He who overcomes will inherit these things, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. We need to be reminded of what we're fighting for. That's where we're going to. If you're striving to live your life by this book, and we're trying to live a life that is surrendered to God, that's what we're surrendering to. That's what we're promised. And we have to be reminded, we have to see that it's worth every struggle. It's worth every effort. It's worth every inconvenience. Every name that we're called. Every time we're mocked or ridiculed for our faith. Every time we're dragged through the mud because we're old-fashioned and because we're backwards. It's worth it. Because that's where we're going. And that's where we can be close to God. And he will be our God, and we will be his son or daughter. Any thoughts, questions, comments as we finish? The bell rung already? 30 seconds. Look at that. Right under the wire. Are you actually counting down 30 seconds? You know, on top of their game back there, man. Any comments or anything? So this ends our class on the surrendered life. Again, a way of reminder of things that we need to be brought up every once in a while and understand who we're fighting for and what it's all about. Thank you very much for your time.